Does anyone know offhand the answer to this question? Suppose that little a and little b are scalars with little b much less than a, then a plus b to the minus 1 has the following Taylor series expansion. Does anyone know what the analog is if a and b are square matrices? As soon as I get past the first term, there's a ordering ambiguity that arises. Like this might be a to the minus 2b, or it might be b times a to the minus 2. Does anyone know how to continue this series? I'm going to be talking about, the context for this type of question is going to be GR, or perturbation theory, where I have a metric, which is a 4x4 matrix, and then I perturb it by some smaller matrix, and I want to organize things in powers of the perturbation. It's not obvious, right? So the answer turns out to be this, and I'll show you how you can derive this. You choose kind of the most democratic ordering, where the A inverses and the B's interleave each other. So to derive it, let me start with the case, sometimes when I don't know how to derive things, I start by thinking about a simple case. And so let me start by thinking about the case where A is the identity matrix. Then no ordering ambiguity arises. And you might conclude that it was safe to write this down. That's actually kind of a jump. So just to give an argument for that, one way you could check it is if you thought that this was true but weren't sure, you could multiply both sides by 1 plus b. That would give the identity matrix on this side. And then on this side, the terms cancel in pairs, you see, when I multiply this. And so I get the identity matrix there, too. And that's a proof. It's a proof, but it's not really a derivation. For a derivation, you might reduce the generality further by rotating to the basis where the B matrix is diagonal. In this basis, it's clear that 1 minus B inverse, if I just have lambdas on the diagonal, then when I take 1 plus b inverse, I just get 1 plus lambdas on the diagonal, and then I flip that over. And then I can do the Taylor series for ordinary scalars here. And then I can recognize the right-hand side as the matrix elements of 1 minus b plus b squared minus b cubed, dot, dot, dot. So another useful trick in linear algebra is to rotate to a basis where a matrix is diagonal and reduce linear algebra questions to questions about ordinary scalars. Now, that only works if there's one matrix. I could do it here because there was only one matrix B, but in the original question, I can't find a basis in which both A and B are diagonal. Unless they commute, in which case there was no ordering ambiguity to begin with. So if you'd figured this out for the case where A is the identity matrix, then you can deduce what happens for an arbitrary A by pulling out the A inverse. Right, this step is okay, even with I pull out the A, have the inverse on the outside. And then there's a, even though the matrices don't commute, this step is okay as long as I don't accidentally switch the ordering here. And then there's an identity in linear algebra that says that the inverse of the product of two matrices is the product of the inverses switched. And now, because I already worked out the case where one of the matrices is equal to 1, I know what to do here. And now if I multiply everything through, I get the result that I want. So linear algebra is hard, but you just need to know the tricks for getting an expression like this. By the way, if the exponent here were different than minus 1, if it were, say, minus 2, then the right-hand side would not be so simple. Each of these terms would be a sum over several different orderings. You can figure out what happens if you revisit this logic with the case of the minus 2 power, or if you just square this identity. So this is a useful identity to remember. We've actually seen the first term already. We talked about, I had described it as like a notational subtlety in GR, that if you perturb the metric, then the inverse metric is, the perturbation in the inverse metric is what you would expect, but with an extra minus sign. If I define my perturbation at the outset to be a perturbation in G with lowered indices, then the associated perturbation in G with, in the inverse metric, G with upper indices, is this. And that's consistent with the statement that, you know, if I take G lower mu nu to be A and delta G lower mu nu to be B, then that's consistent with the statement that A plus B inverse, let me write this identity as G plus delta G. Well, that's consistent with the statement that the first order change in A plus B inverse, the first order term is minus A inverse B A inverse. It's the same minus sign. But since we're about to do second order perturbation theory, it's useful to know how you generate more terms. Another case that's going to come up when I perturb the metric is to work out expand the square root of minus g in powers of delta g. So for that, I need a formula for the determinant of A plus B. So I'll show you how to solve this linear algebra problem. The question is, I have a matrix A and I perturb it by some small matrix B. How do I expand the determinant and powers of the matrix B? So the first thing you might do following this example is to consider the case where A is the identity matrix. Even in this case, it's not totally clear what to do. But what you might do is say, well, what if I restrict the generality further and say that B is diagonal? I'll rotate to the basis where that's diagonal. Okay. In that case, I can start making progress. If B is the diagonal matrix of lambdas on the diagonal, then the determinant of the identity matrix plus that is just the product of 1 plus each lambda. Now, if I want to expand this product in powers of the lambdas, then one thing you might do is write it as e to the sum of log 1 plus lambda. And then I'll expand this out. I can just do the ordinary Taylor series for scalar lambdas to get this. if I do the following thing, if I say the sum of the lambdas, well, that is the trace of B. And the sum of the lambda squared is the trace of B squared. I want to convert back to some linear algebra notation. This is the trace of B cubed and so on. Now I have a identity that says the determinant of I plus B is equal to this series in B. And I derived the identity assuming that B was a diagonal matrix, but since every matrix can be rotated to a basis in which it's diagonal, then the identity must be true for any matrix B. So that's a nice identity. That's almost there. This, by the way, is one more comment, but let me actually reverse the order of what I was going to say. Let's go back to the original question and do the determinant of A plus B. So I'll pull out the A. And then there's a identity for determinants that says the determinant of a product is the product of the determinants. And when I take the determinant of 1 plus A inverse B, I know how to expand that. So by the previous case, this is you can see it's coming out again in this form where the A inverses and the B's end up interleaved. By the way, if I had written these traces down in the other order, like written B A inverse here, you might wonder, well, how does the trace know to be of A inverse B rather than B A inverse? What determines that ordering? And they're the same by an those two orderings are the same when you put them inside a trace by the property of the trace that you can cyclically permute a product inside it. Okay, and then. If I wanted to multiply this out to make it a little more straightforward to use as a power series in B, then I can do that because what's inside the X pair is just a number. It's not a matrix. So I can use the ordinary Taylor series for an X to write this as, let me just write the linear and the quadratic terms. There'll be a term that looks like 1 half trace A inverse B, A inverse B, plus a term that looks like 1 half trace A inverse B squared. And that second term comes from, you know, when I take e to the x, where this whole thing is x, then that contains a 1 half x squared, a 1 half x squared in its Taylor expansion, so I get 1 half times this squared. And you could calculate more terms. I didn't write out the whole cubic term, but there'll be three terms in the cubic term, I believe. Okay. We've actually already seen this first term. That was this Jacobi formula that says that if I differentiate a determinant, that is if I just consider the first term in its Taylor series, that I get the same determinant times the trace of A inverse delta A. But this general argument is what you go through if you need more terms in the series. Okay, so that was just a little linear algebra break in which I wanted to derive this formula and this formula. Okay, now let's go back to GR. So the next couple of lectures are going to be a continuation of the GR class disguised as a cosmology calculation. The cosmology calculation can be done in kind of a nice way that's not too much algebra, but you need a lot of machinery that's not usually covered in a first GR class. So what I'm going to do is build up some machinery, and I won't be quite as systematic as in a GR class, because I'll don't need to cover like every formula. I just need some selected formulas to do the calculation. But I'll try to be I'll try to explain the concepts well, because I think they're very interesting. GR is just a really beautiful subject. It's fun to talk about. The concepts that I'm going to cover, by the way, to do the calculation are perturbation theory in GR. I'm going to talk about the Lie derivative and gauge transformations. I'm going to talk about extrinsic curvature and something called the ADM formalism. So these are pure GR topics that I'll talk about in a general way. Now, I was almost done. Last time I was talking about perturbation theory in GR, and I was almost done, but there's one more thing I want to write down, which is that, so we had this formula up on the board. And the context of this was that I was thinking about a situation. Well, let me write down the definition of C. C is this tensor. This is also the difference between the two sets of Christoffel symbols. The context for this is that I was imagining a situation where I have two metrics, one of which is a small perturbation of the other. And G bar here will probably be, actually, let me write the delta G as H. And probably G bar is a simple metric, like, say, the unperturbed FRW metric. And G is a complicated metric that differs by some small perturbation, like I have fluctuations in the components of the metric and maybe the inflaton too. But this formula is nice because, these formulas are nice because they actually are just true for any two metrics with no assumption that the perturbation is small. They're true to all orders, in other words, in the difference G minus G bar. And so you can expand them to whatever order you like in the perturbations. Now I'm going to do that. What we'll need for our calculation is we're interested in understanding the form of the Einstein-Hilbert action in the case where the metric G bar is an unperturbed FRW metric, and we're expanding to second order in metric fluctuations. So that's a calculation that we have all of the tools to do. If I tell you that G bar is the unperturbed FRW metric and H could be anything, then you can calculate this tensor. This will turn out to be something of order H. And then it's a pairing squared here. So you only need to calculate this to order H. And then you can plug it in and get this to order H squared. R bar is something that we've calculated before, the Ricci tensor for an unperturbed FRW metric. These two factors are troublemakers. We need to know, to expand them, we need to know how to expand the inverse metric to second order in the fluctuations. But that's what this formula was for. And we also need to know how to expand the determinant, or rather its square root, to second order in the fluctuations. But that's what this formula is for. So you have all the ingredients you need. And I made it an exercise in today's tutorial to derive the following formula. Which we'll need. It doesn't look so bad on the page, but when I actually have to write the whole thing on the board, I appreciate how many terms there actually are. By the way, I'm going to put some notes with all of this GR material on the wiki as soon as possible. Probably not before the tutorial, but hopefully like this evening. Okay. And so this is the formula, and it is, let me put plus order h cubed, just to emphasize that this is an expansion to second order in H. And let me also say that this is, in this formula, all indices have been raised or lowered with G bar. Remember there's this like, annoying notational ambiguity when you have two metrics that an expression like this one, say. The tensor H was defined with two lower indices, so when I write it with two upper indices, it's ambiguous which metric I used. This ambiguity, by the way, only arises for, is only important for this term, because it's the only term that is first order in H. In the second order terms, it wouldn't matter which metric you use to raise and lower the indices, because the difference between those two would be one more power of h. We give a third order difference. So this formula is very non-trivial to get. Requires, you know, some calculation. As a nice check on it, what's appearing here in the first order term is the barred Einstein tensor. And that is expected because we know that when you expand the Einstein-Hilbert action in powers of fluctuations in the metric, that the first order term, or that is to say the functional derivative of the action with respect to the metric, is just the Einstein tensor times the fluctuation. That's why Einstein's tensor appears in Einstein's equations. But these other terms, you know, are new and appear when you expand to second order.
What about the almost Einstein tensor? Is that weird or?
Oh yeah, I was sort of scratching my head over this. It wasn't obvious that this factorization had to occur. You get four terms here, and when I noticed that they factored like this, and then I also noticed that this tensor, I was wondering if this tensor had some significance in GR. I also noticed that with the 1/4, this is the factor that makes Einstein equation look symmetric in the Ricci curvature and the stress energy. So maybe there's some, maybe it has some significance. There's some deep reason why it appears at second order, but maybe this is a GR thing I don't know about. Okay, so this formula is useful in all sorts of situations where you want to understand the action to second order. And for example, and I actually didn't specialize the metric, the background metric G bar to be FRW. So you could use it, for example, if you wanted to understand like the quasi-normal modes of a black hole. You could expand around the Schwarzschild metric to see that black holes are stable. You could also take this formula and expand around Minkowski so that this curvature term would be zero, and this one too. And I think this was something that you guys did in the first GR course, right? Is looked at the action of gravity waves expanded around the FRW background. This expanded around a Minkowski background. In Minkowski, this collection of terms would be the action for some linearly propagating gravity waves. Okay. So that's all I have to say. These formulas that are up on the board now are all that I have to say about perturbation theory in GR. I think this topic can be covered pretty quickly since it's conceptually very straightforward. We're just thinking about what happens when you expand a metric and powers of some fluctuations and expanding everything in sight. The formulas are sort of straightforward to interpret and use, long but straightforward. There are no new geometric objects that we had to that appeared, for example. So now I'm going to move on to some topics that really do involve some new geometric constructions. And I'm going to start by talking about the Lie derivative. So the reason that we're going to be interested in the Lie derivative is the following. We're thinking about, so we talked about the background solution for single field inflation. And now we're slowly building up machinery to analyze the perturbations. But here's a funny thing that can happen. Suppose in the background, the metric is a function of time with no x dependence, and so is phi. So if I consider phi, for example, its level surfaces would just be the level surfaces of phi would just be the surfaces of constant time. But general relativity is a reparameterization invariant theory, or we say diffeomorphism invariant. I can take an arbitrary nonlinear parameterization, change of coordinates, in which the surfaces of constant time are different. And in those coordinates, I would say that the surfaces of constant phi were warped, or equivalently that phi had some x dependence. And then it looks like phi does have some fluctuation delta phi around its background solution. So the question of whether or not there is a perturbation, a non-zero perturbation around the background, is a coordinate dependent question. One way to think about this is that there are some modes some particular choices of perturbations delta g and delta phi which are gauge modes. Some modes higher gauge modes, meaning that they can be spuriously produced starting from the background solution by simply applying a nonlinear coordinate transformation. And these have no physical significance. They shouldn't be interpreted as, propagating dynamical degrees of freedom of the theory. They just reflect the fact that GR has a redundancy of description. In GR, because of this coordinate freedom, we can describe the same physics in many different coordinate systems. And so there are physically, there are different looking perturbations that describe the same physics. So if a perturbation is a pure gauge mode, then it's not physical. And if two perturbations differ by a gauge mode, then we should think of them as being physically equivalent. Now what I'd like to do is find the gauge modes. It turns out there'll be four. Out of the single field inflation has 11 fields in it, the 10 components of the metric plus phi. Out of those 11 independent modes, four of them will be unphysical gauge modes. To answer this question, a nice, clean way of answering this question, which is also generally useful to know about, is to introduce something called the Lie derivative. So to motivate the definition of the Lie derivative, the Lie derivative is a way of differentiating a tensor field, which is not the usual covariant derivative. So suppose I have a tensor with one one lower and one upper index. Then if I consider the transformation law for such a tensor, under a general change of coordinates, it transforms like this. So there's two Jacobians. The upper index has the mu prime, has the prime upstairs. And then the lower index has the prime downstairs. Consider this transformation law. In the limit where the change of coordinates is like an infinitesimal change, so we want to consider the case where x prime is obtained from x by just adding some small shift, where epsilon mu is a small, let's say, first order vector field. This is defined with a minus sign. The usual definition of the Lie derivative has a minus in it, so that I would get the plus going from x prime to x. And then if I expand the right-hand side, to first order and epsilon, then here's what I get. Um, So this guy, this Jacobian, is an identity matrix plus, let's see, so here the prime was upstairs, so I take the derivative of this guy with the minus sign, and so I get a minus. Epsilon. I wrote it in the notes with a lambda. Now here I'm taking the derivative of x with respect to x prime. So I take the derivative of this with respect to x prime, and I get the plus sign. So I get sigma nu plus the partial derivative with respect to nu of epsilon sigma. Another way of thinking about it is that the two of these different signs is that the two Jacobians with the prime upstairs or downstairs are inverse matrices of each other. So this minus sign appears when you invert the matrix, as we saw before. And that, and then, so these were the expansions of the Jacobian to first order in epsilon. And I'm also going to expand this guy. In the transformation law, the coordinates where the tensor is evaluated are different on the two sides. I have an x prime here and an x here. So I want to make this into an x prime by Taylor expanding. So I'll say that x is x prime plus epsilon. And I get a term here that looks like epsilon lambda partial lambda s. All that I did here is expand s at x Taylor series around the point x prime. Okay. And now if I collect terms and contract a bunch of Kronecker deltas, I get this result. With everybody evaluated at the point x prime. This answer, which has this term, which has appeared, this is the complete expansion. If I make a small change in coordinates, this is the change in the components of a tensor field. This is defined to be the Lie derivative. Along the vector field epsilon of the tensor S. In general, okay, I guess I have to write over here. I did the calculation for a tensor with one upper and one lower index. But in general, the Lie derivative for a tensor T with m upper indices and n lower indices is another tensor. Let's say the Lie derivative L epsilon T is another tensor with the same number of upper and lower indices. And the general definition, which you can see by the same argument, works like this. There's one term where I take a partial derivative of the partial derivatives of the components of the tensor and contract with epsilon. And then for each upper index, there is a term with a minus sign where I use the, or I contract the tensor, I contract the upper index. And what I contract with is the matrix of derivatives of epsilon. So the rho goes here, the mu goes here. And the upper indices get a minus sign. And then for each lower index, I have a term where again, I want to contract with the derivatives of epsilon, but here the rho has to go on the epsilon and the nu goes here. And so you might compare this formula with, by the way, one thing that you can check, I guess this is important to check, is that with this definition, the Lie derivative is a tensor. If I make a change of coordinates from x to x prime, then this right-hand side, it's not obvious at all, satisfies the transformation law for a tensor with m upper indices and n lower indices. So that's interesting that out of this idea of thinking about a very small change of coordinates, one can find a new way of differentiating a tensor that doesn't have anything to do with a covariant derivative. And so you might compare this with the covariant derivative in the epsilon direction. Remember, that's defined when I write the covariant derivative with a vector field down here. That's just defined to be the usual covariant derivative contracted with epsilon. So let's write that out. There's a term that looks like this. And then for each upper index, there's a term where if you look at what it gets contracted with, that's now this combination of the Christoffel symbol and epsilon. Let's see, this has to go here. Mu goes here. And then this. And then for each lower index, get a term like this. See, now the rho has to go up here. The nu goes here, so here. Okay, cool. So this looks like it's like almost the same thing. It's just the only difference is what you contract with in these extra terms. Here you're contracting with derivatives of the epsilon field that has the right index structure to contract with. And here you're contracting with, well, what you're contracting with is like itself a contraction between the components of epsilon, not their derivatives, and a Christoffel symbol. So in calculations, they sort of feel similar, but conceptually they're very different. So the Lie derivative is sort of lower level in the sense that you don't need a metric on the space or anything to define it. It really just derives from the way that tensors transform under coordinate transformations. The covariant derivative, on the other hand, involves the metric or the coefficients of this connection, which derive from the metric, some extra geometric structure. You need to know about distances between points or have some notion of geometry to make sense of the covariant derivative. The Lie derivative depends on derivatives of the vector field epsilon, whereas the covariant derivative just depends on the values of those components. So the covariant derivative, you know, is just something, you just need a direction. To define the covariant derivative, you just need the vector field epsilon to be defined at a single point. If you wanted to find the covariant derivative, work out what the covariant derivative is at that point. So that matches up better with our notion of a directional derivative. The Lie derivative, on the other hand, you need to know not just the value of the vector field, which direction you're differentiating in, but also its derivatives at that point, which is a little different. On a related note, you can make sense of the covariant derivative without the epsilon in front. In covariant derivative land, I can take the covariant derivative directionally in the direction of some vector field and get a tensor with the same number of indices. Or I can just take the covariant derivative with an index and get a tensor with one more index. In the Lie derivative, you can't do that. The Lie derivative is only defined given a vector field epsilon. It can't be written in the same way like this. And there's no notion of a Lie derivative with a mu, which is a tensor with one more index. So the covariant derivative matches better like our intuition of what a directional derivative should be, and it tends to arise more often in calculations. But the Lie derivative arises if you're thinking about coordinate transformations or like symmetries of a spacetime. For example, if you want to just find all the symmetries of the metric, all the coordinate transformations that leave the metric unchanged, you could just write down this equation. Every vector field epsilon that satisfies this equation is an infinitesimal symmetry of the metric. So by writing down this equation and solving it for FRW, say, you could prove a statement that we made earlier, that the only symmetries of a general FRW spacetime are translations and rotations. Now, the Lie derivative is actually a very fascinating object, and it has lots of interesting mathematical properties. And so I had to make a judgment call on it. I don't want to talk about it in too much length, but it's so interesting that I just couldn't resist telling you a few more things about the Lie derivative. So first off, one may observe that in the case where the tensor being Lie derivatived is a vector with one upper index, then the Lie derivative turns out to be antisymmetric in the vector fields x and y. If you write it out, it's by the definition, it's x nu delta nu y mu minus. Then there's there's one contraction term which has the minus sign, and then I contract with the derivatives of x, so it looks like this. And This is anti-symmetric at x and y. So the commutator of two vector fields is defined to be the Lie derivative of one with respect to the other. And this commutator satisfies a bunch of identities that are also satisfied by commutators of matrices or operators. For example, there's the Jacobian identity, something that you've seen before, I'm sure. So this is an interesting mathematical operation. You can take two vector fields on a space and form their commutator and get another vector field. And you don't need a metric or anything to do it. So here's a concrete way of thinking about it, a concrete geometric way of thinking about it. Suppose I have two vector fields, x and y, and I start integrating along the x vector field for some, I integrate along x for some duration epsilon. Then I integrate along the y field for some direction epsilon. And then I integrate along, you see where this is going? I integrate along minus x for length epsilon, and then minus y for some distance epsilon. In general, there's no reason why you have to end up exactly where you started. If you work this out, I'm not going to work it out. I'll just tell you what answer you get. The combination of all of these integrals gives you some difference between where you started and where you ended up, which is proportional to epsilon squared. And the coefficient of the epsilon squared is the Lie derivative. This displacement is the commutator. Is the commutator of x and y, that's a vector times epsilon squared, plus terms of order epsilon cubed. So this really does, the commutator notation does make a kind of sense. It's quantifying the failure of the flows defined by the vector fields if I integrate along those vector fields for those flows to commute with each other. Another property which is useful to know, one more, is that the only other formula that I think I'm going to need is that, again, in this case where I'm Lie differentiating a vector field, then another formula for the Lie derivative or the commutator is given by the covariant derivative of x with respect to y minus the covariant derivative of y with respect to x. And this is very easy to prove. If you write it out, then you'll get this combination of derivatives that appear in the Lie derivative, plus two extra terms which cancel each other because of the symmetry of the Christoffel symbol and its indices. In fact, this identity is true. This identity is equivalent to the torsion freeness of the connection or the symmetry property in the lower indices. All right. Now let's go back to, oh my God, almost an hour. Back to the original question of what are the gauge modes of single field inflation? To answer this question, or more generally to answer it for any theory, you just Lie derivative everything in sight. So the linear derivative with respect to some vector field epsilon of phi is I'm taking the lead derivative of the background. So g mu nu is the FRW metric. And phi is just a function of time. So if phi is just a function of time, then its lead derivative, when I take the lead derivative of a scalar, there are no contraction terms, and I just get this. And since phi only depends on time, the only term here is the zero term, epsilon zero phi dot. So that one is trivial. Here are some less trivial ones. If I need to take the lead derivative of the metric and then take its zero, zero component, I get this. I get some more interesting answers because I can get like derivatives of the epsilon field because of the extra terms in the lead derivative. And the zero I component, I get that. So a perturbation, these are the right-hand sides here, represent the spurious perturbation, which is produced by a small coordinate change starting from the unperturbed background. So for any choice of epsilon zero and epsilon I, I have a gauge mode given by these formulas. They describe the perturbation in phi and the perturbation in all components of the metric. So those are the gauge modes. There are four functions to specify. So that's the sense in which you appear to have 11 fields in the theory, but once you remove the gauge symmetry, there are only seven. Configurations of the perturbations whose difference is a gauge mode. That is to say, if I difference the two perturbations, then I get a perturbation which is of this form for some choice of epsilon zero and epsilon I. Two sets of perturbations which are related to each other in that way are physically equivalent because there's a small coordinate transformation that takes one to the other. This will be a good place to stop. Tomorrow I'll talk mostly about extrinsic curvature and the idiom formulation.